Well, I wanted to take some time just to go through what the last 4 weeks have been like for us. We really had three trips in one. We had 2 weeks at FI, Foundation Institute, and we did take some time off. My brother and his wife have an 80-acre ranch in Burleson, Texas, about an hour and 20 minutes from the headquarters office. They're just outside Fort Worth. I think they have about 25 head of cattle, 27, something like that. They had one less after we left that week. My brother, he said, we have one steer that he says, I call him Freezer Boy. Because that's where he was going. He said, that is the meanest, most contrary, most, you know, ornery steer. Well, his wife, Michelle, says Freezer Boy's final, payback is probably going to be that his meat will be tough and inedible when they finally get it back. So I don't know. We'll see. But that's Freezer Boy made his departure while we were there. So we, and then of course we followed with the conference, and then my wife actually had to sub in for me. There was another day of international meetings on Wednesday, but I was unable to attend because I had a day and a half of doctrine committee meetings overlapping on the same day. So she sat in on the international meetings, which ended early. They had only a morning instead of a whole day. And then I had about a day and a half of doctrine committee meetings. Nothing major to cover, just updating, going over some new editing procedures, programs we hope to use. It'll be a little easier for us to review documents because as a committee, we review everything that the church publishes before it goes out. So sometimes that can be a little bit daunting, as you might well imagine. But I thought I would go through some of the material. The Foundation Institute, we spent the first 2 weeks of our trip there, but it was the last 2 weeks of the module for the first year of the new class, Modern Church History. I'll have just a brief mention of that with the conference as well, but this was essentially what I presented at the conference. So the Koontzes have heard this already, but I'd appreciate it if you didn't take a nap during the next portion of the message. If you do, preferably no snoring. And definitely no falling off the chair and, you know, that kind of thing. But we did have a lot of comments. There were a lot of very kind words, and certainly from the students themselves as we finished up the class. We had the graduation of the ninth graduating class, August the 15th. We were privileged to attend that. Mr. Giese gave the commencement address, the pastor in Fort Worth. He and his wife and two other elders and wives found out on this, as the first day of the conference was ending, that they had all been at their Tulsa congregation on Sabbath before the conference started, and one of the members in Tulsa tested positive and learned about it Sunday, the day after the Sabbath. They found out about it just in time to say, well, we have to leave after day one of the conference. So we've had some other issues. The phone calls I was making beforehand involved some scrambling in Cleveland this afternoon because our webcast team is knocked out for the afternoon. So they weren't around anyway since last Sabbath, but this is just what sometimes is happening. But at any rate, we were privileged to be part of the graduation ceremonies. This class was part of the curriculum for the first time. There have been others added since Foundation Institute began in 2012. They've added a couple of other classes over the time, but it's getting to the point now where if they put anything else in, something's got to be removed. They're just so packed full of sessions. And our class, my class, the Modern Church History, which my wife is fully a part of preparing, I do the original notes. She somehow translates and unscrambles them into a PowerPoint presentation, so we can use that for the students as well. And we've had a couple of suggestions from our son to sharpen that a little bit more, and we've managed to make it a family affair. But it was the curriculum for the first time. I'm told before that those who've gone before me that the second year you make some adjustments. Dr. Levy is very precise. He said, the first year I was adjusting on the fly as I was, making notes, change. Second year, he said, I was 70% where I wanted to go. Dr. Levy is very precise. And the third year, then okay, then we can just keep up and make adjustments, keeping up to date. I was first approached by Mr. David Johnson at the Winter Family Weekend in 2019 with the idea of researching and putting together material for the class because there was no previous curriculum. The curriculum was the last 200 years of history. And it's no problem. We have 20 whole classes to cover 200 years. So in 80 minutes, we have 80 minutes for every 10 years that go by. So it's challenging. I was a little concerned because he had asked shortly before that to step down from the doctrine committee due to his responsibilities at FI and wanting to research more and present a better curriculum for his part with the epistles that he teaches and so on. And so he stepped down, and apparently, I'm not sure how it came up, but my name was put forward to join the doctrine committee in his place, and that had happened only 6 weeks before I saw him at the Winter Family Weekend. So when I saw him coming toward me again and saying he needed to talk with me, I told him, if he starts walking toward me, I'm running from now on. But we had a pleasant talk, and the idea was a class that would cover roughly 200 years of history, to go back well before the story we're so familiar with, because most of us, I think, in the church are familiar with two stories for church history. The one that begins with the calling and conversion of Herbert and Loma Armstrong in the late 1920s, and the one that begins on the day of Pentecost in AD 31 in Jerusalem. Those are the two history stories we're familiar with. But there's a lot of material in between, and there are some interesting characters, I would say that, as well as interesting developments in the 200 years that we do cover. So he told me then that the administration of the church and foundation felt that they were seeing something in the students that they needed to address, and that is, as time goes by, the things that seem to many of us like yesterday are actually literally history to them. If you saw the last edition of In Accord, which was produced last week, mostly by the students, you will have heard one of the students, Scott McIntosh, talk about the fact that he said, Mr. Armstrong died before I was born. Well, Scott's in his mid-30s. He's not a typical college-age student. He's been out of school for some time, but came back to Foundation Institute this year. He's a fine man. He's a gentle giant, and he insisted on giving us a hug every morning. And basically, my wife said she felt like she was like a little kid being comforted by a dad again, because she's looking up at this fellow. And he's actually going to further his career now. He wants to be a pediatric nurse. If you can imagine a man who's about 6'5" or 6'6", and you know, solidly built, the kids will either be greatly comforted or run screaming for the other room. I'm not sure which, but he's a fine, fine man, and we enjoyed getting to know him a bit better. But as he was simply an illustration. One of the other younger students, who was 23, for example, was only 12 years old when the Church of God, a worldwide association, was started in late December of 2010. He was 12, and now he's college age, and actually past college age in some ways, 23, and that's many have graduated by that time. So the thinking was, we need to have some vehicle to help guide our young people into seeing where they came from. Because it's in our current world, in our current culture, it seems like the present is all that anybody pays attention to. You know, the dopamine hits from going on Facebook and scanning this and that and the other thing, jumping around to everything else, and very few actually study things anymore and get into a deeper understanding of issues. In a way, the class had its beginning, or its genesis, I guess you'd say, back in 2015. I don't know if any of the ones who are here now were at the Young Adult Leadership Weekend that year in 2015, but the theme was Living Stones, Your Part in Strengthening God's House. And Mr. Franks had the keynote address, and it was webcast and recorded to some of the locations where he wasn't in attendance, and his title was History of the Modern Church, Where Are We Today? And he went back into some of the issues. He went all the way back to England and colonial New England and some of those time periods, and came a little bit forward as well. He gave a sermon on similar material about 2 or 3 years ago with a quarterly sermon. And we know that the up-and-coming generation in the church is going to need a grasp of the lessons of the past in order to become leaders of the future. George Santayana's famous statement, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it," is true in church history too. And as one of the students said in one of the class discussions, he said, "I always thought before I took this class that secular history was over here and church history was over here." But he says, "Now I can see how when God says we're in the world but not of the world, they blend. They influence each other. They impact each other. We live in a culture and in a time, and it does have an impact on God's people." Another theme that I ask the students to remember always is a statement from a British novelist, Leslie Poles Hartley. He's usually just referred to as L.P. Hartley. And he wrote a novel in the early 1950s that began with these words: "The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there." And that's important for all of us to remember. Those of us who've lived through significant segments of history, which is increasingly true for all of us, I guess, know that, but for young people, it's not so clear. And the temptation might be to take the world that we live in now, a kind of a 21st century template, and lay it over anything they see from the past. But that just doesn't work. That's not the way the world was, say, in 1950 or 1930 or 1880 or AD 31, for that matter. And so that was something we continually stressed. Because since God has drawn the called out ones to the knowledge of his way, but not removed them from the world in which we all live, and we know that, it helps to know a little bit about the times in which our brothers and sisters of the past live. So this class incorporates some secular history along with church history to see how the two influence each other. We talk about the called and converted people of the past in the class. We call them Waldo, as in, "Where's Waldo?" And we have the little, you know, the little things you've seen, the artwork, where there's this huge crowd of people, and somewhere in there, there's one that is standing out, and that's Waldo. That's the called out converted Christian in the world of his or her day. I bet you didn't know that Waldo could be a female name, too. At least in our class, it is. Maybe we should call her Waldina or something. I don't know, but... But that's the focus. We are not of this world, even though for now we live in it. That's a big part of the focus of the class, and we take a look for about the last 200 years. There are 20 classes in the curriculum, with each one structured to last 80 minutes. We take a short break about an hour in, and then we have a discussion period to finish the final 10 to 15 minutes. It's taught over a period of roughly 2-week modules, although going forward we'll have to make an adjustment in December because it coincides with the meeting of the Ministerial Board of Directors, which Mr. Franks sits in on, even though he's not part of the directors. He's the president, and he would normally teach class 2 going forward, but he won't be available until the third day. So what we're going to have to do is double up a couple of classes in that first week so that we'll have five classes in 3 days when we go in December. He'll teach one of them, but I'll have the other four. But generally, it's going to be December and May, mid-December and early May going forward this past year, because the whole academic year got slid down to January to August. It was late April and early August this time. The first class sets the tone. I lay out the direction we're going to go, what the students can expect to hear, what the goal of the class is, why we have it in the first place. And Mr. Franks presents the results of his research as a bit of background on the Sabbatarians that came from England to the colonial world, a new world. And then we get right into the history from about the early 1800s, the early 19th century. We start essentially with a Protestant evangelical minister named William Miller. Some of you may have heard his name, because although he was not part of the church, he was a Sunday keeper, but he was a strong believer in the return of Jesus Christ, and he preached it. In fact, he predicted it. He said Jesus Christ would return, first he said, in the fall of 1843, and he preached and preached and preached, and people left their homes, sold their homes, went out and waited on a mountain in New York, and nothing happened. So then he went back and recalculated and said he'd made a mistake, and he forgot about the fact that the Roman system didn't recognize the concept of the number or the year zero. There is no zero in the Roman calendar, which most of you probably are aware. The year before 1 AD is not zero. There was no zero. It was 1 BC. So you have to kind of tweak as you're doing the math coming from one to the other to make up for that lost space. So then he said, well, it's going to be 1844. Well, guess what happened in 1844? Nothing. Christ didn't come back, and it was called the Great Disappointment. But part of his audience, because it was focused so much on the return of Jesus Christ, which is something, of course, we in God's church focus on and believe, part of his audience consisted of members of a tiny little group called the Church of God. And so that's really where we pick it up. Those tiny little audiences, those independent little congregations, there was very little connecting them. There wasn't a world communicating back and forth like our world. The past is a foreign country. And so they were part of his audience, and that's really where we pick it up. They usually called themselves the Church of God at, Newport, Rhode Island, for example, or the Church of God at Westerly or Hopkinton, or the Church of God at Piscataway or whatever. But others tended to refer to them by their beliefs. They would call them Seventh-day Baptists because they kept the Sabbath and they believed in baptism by immersion. Some later on began to call them Seventh-day Adventists because they believed in the advent or the return of Christ. But by 1860, a parting of the ways came between the Adventists and the tiny Church of God. And that's part of the history we go into. I won't repeat it all now, but that's where we start. By the time you come to the Civil War, there were a handful of churches, mostly in the American Midwest. It had started in Rhode Island back in colonial times, but it had spread. Rhode Island was the colony or the state later with the most religious freedom, and that's why they began there. But they had moved to the Midwest. There were groups in Iowa, there were groups in Michigan, there were groups in northern Missouri, groups in West Virginia, but back then, before 1863, it was just Virginia. West Virginia became a state in 1863 during the Civil War. But there were names involved, many of them you probably haven't heard of, but we learned about them in history. Gilbert Cranmer, who engaged in a series of letters back and forth with Ellen G. White, Seventh-day Adventist Church, where they debated all kinds of things. There was one we'd probably agree with her. She didn't think he should be chewing tobacco, and he didn't want to give it up. So I guess there was some differences. You can be grateful you don't have ministers up here giving sermons while they're chewing, you know, and carry a little, cuspidor or something to take care of the chew. They don't do that in the Church of God. But Andrew F. Duggar was a name, Greenberry George Rupert or G.G. Rupert, Andrew N. Duggar, the son of A.F. Duggar, Clarence Dodd. These are names in the Church of God history in the late 1800s, late 19th century and early 20th. I've had the privilege of talking with Andrew Duggar's granddaughter. She's a member of CAGWA, lives in Branson, Missouri. We had a fascinating talk. She lived with her grandparents for 10 years in Jerusalem during the latter part of his ministry with Church of God Seventh Day. She was there as a 16-year-old during the Six-Day War in 1967. So you can imagine some stories that she had to tell. Some of these groups worked more or less independently of each other's. Others tried to band together. By the early 1920s, the most recognizable group was the Church of God Seventh Day with a publishing center in Stanbury, Missouri. And that's basically where most of us would begin to pick up the story. Andrew Duggar, N. Duggar, was the president. And that's where the Armstrongs came into contact in Oregon with a branch of that church, the Oregon Conference of the Church of God Seventh Day. So, as we say, the rest is history for us, but we go into it. About half of the 10 classes, roughly, we cover that period of time from the conversion of the Armstrongs in 1926 until really the split with Worldwide that formed the group, that the pattern many of us have followed. I explained to them that I'm going to follow the most common path. Those of us who are where we are now in the Church of God Worldwide Association, the most common path has been via the United Church of God from the mid-90s to this point where we are now. So that's the path we trace going through for about 10 class periods. The establishment of the colleges, the explosive growth of the church, the high point in attendance, and then the growing sense that something's wrong, something's happening, what's going on in the late 80s, but especially picking up into the early 1990s. Other guest lecturers besides Mr. Franks are Mr. Leon Walker, who talks about Brickett Wood and the growth of the international offices. Mr. Clyde Kylo takes half of one class on outreach. He talks about the Big Dig in Jerusalem, brought some interesting slides, and pointed out some names that the students would recognize. Names, yes. Faces, no. From 50 years ago, things have changed, He said, that's Ken Trabig right over there. And you see the student looking, I'm not so sure about that. Or that's Britton Taylor right there. Or Judy Servideo, as she is now, Judy Bishop back then, he had a few names to point out. The last five classes basically deal with the effects of Mr. Armstrong's death, the eventual departure from the core teachings of the Church of God, the eventual open acceptance of mainstream Protestant teachings, what we might call the post-WCG time of God's church. You know what we found as Nell and I prepared for this last 2 weeks to present? It was painful. as I'm sure you can imagine. It's part of our history, and that's the way we teach all of this. We point out the history of the Church of God. And as I state when we get into it, I say we come to the life of an elder who his ministry was markedly different from what went before him. And that's the way we approach the understanding that we have, and where many of us gained a deeper understanding of a lot of things we know. So, once again, Santayana's comment, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. So we talk pretty openly about what happened in 1995, and reasonably openly about what happened in 2008 to 2010 and 11. And we found as we sort of had to relive it all, a lot of it was pretty painful. And that's just the way things are, because that's the class that needs to be taught. Finally, we wrap it up with a couple of classes. In the second to the last one, class 19, we take a look at the church right now that we're familiar with, COGWA, the Church of God, a worldwide association. And the concept, the focus of the class is passing the baton. The idea being, we have an aging church, we have an aging ministry, except for a handful of us, the present company accepted. Let me just put it this way. The doctrine committee is composed of 5 people. I'm the youngest. But by December, everybody on the doctrine committee will be 70 or more. So you can figure out what that means. But that's just the way it is. Where will we be 10 years from now? I can assure you that I don't think it's capable. I'll be capable of pastoring 2 or 3 churches when I'm 80. There must be a passing of the baton. And so we focus on what's the church doing to pass the baton. And that's the class 19. In the last class, we come back full circle to the students. It's mostly discussion. It will be hard when we do go to an FI online presence. That one probably won't be able to be put online in the same way, because it's mostly discussion. We talk about what have you learned, what do you see now differently than you knew before. It's a lot of back and forth and input from the class. We talk about, most of all, knowing how something about how God's people of the last 200 years have managed to live in this world while not being of this world can help them do the same thing and establish a connection. As they know what their heritage is, where they came from, as Tori Hudson said, one of the presenters and In Accord, along with Kendrick Diaz, she said, if you don't know where you came from, then how do you know where you're headed? And that was well said, and my wife and I were sitting back as we watched that sneak preview, and it was pretty touching to see the recognition that, in that sense, they got it. And we were very pleased. And so now it's just a matter of, it'd be a little bit more relaxed, I think, in the succeeding years. Dr. Levy and Mr. Johnson and I all talked about the concept of FI Online, because I've had at least 200 people ask me that question, including several at the conference. I made a joke about having had 197 questions, and somebody immediately came up and said, I'm number 198. So, and the answer is, I don't know. That's above my pay grade, as they say. I know that Mr. Johnson wants, they're doing general epistles going forward in the fall after the feast. Mr. Johnson thinks it would be important to do the book of Romans and get that up there as well, because it's not there yet. So this class won't be ready, even if we will begin taping in December. We'll begin recording in December. But then the class won't be done until May, and if they do general epistles and Romans, it might not be until spring of 2023. So it depends on what is deemed most important and most needful. And that's all I can tell you about that. Well, that was the FI. That was the first 2 weeks. Then we took a week off at the ranch. Been roping and branding cattle all week. I was so tired when it was done. Took care of Freezer Boy. No. They have a nice pool, I will say that. But Sugar, the Great Pyrenees, thinks that she should greet everybody all the time, every day, and wants to have her belly rubbed every day. So, you know, what are you going to do? Then we came back for the conference, and so I want to take a little bit of time to give just a kind of a sneak review of the conference, and the theme. It was different this year. 2 years ago, we had a very joyful conference, I would say, 2019. Everything was looking like great guns. We dedicated the new office building. That's a tool God's given us, and we still believe that. It's a tool He's given us. We were on the verge of heading for Israel for a 10-day tour of Israel. And Kuntzes know all about that because they were part of it. And we share all kinds of pictures and good memories and funny memories from that trip. Mr. Kuntz will remember the lobby of, you know, the hotel in Jerusalem, where he and Gary Summers and I and Dr. Levy sometimes would retire for, after a hot, dusty day of traveling, a gold star on tap felt pretty good. So we'd meet in the lobby most evenings. But that was ahead. Israel was ahead. We had just done the conference. We dedicated the building. The International Leadership Program was looking so good. The first round was just being completed in 2019, 10 different venues. And then 2020 arrived. And it started okay. We had a sad journey to make in the very first few days to Newfoundland to do a funeral when Blanche Smith died, the wife of our elder David Smith, who has since relocated to Nova Scotia to be closer to his daughter. But, and then we went to Montreal on an area visit in the tail end of February, and 2 weeks after we got home, everything slammed shut. There were two meetings of the round, second round of the International Leadership Program, in Latin, both in Latin America, and then the rest of it had to be virtual, had to be all online. They've got ILP3 ready to roll out, because as we look forward, the international, if the U.S. ministry is aging, and they're being replaced. We are being replaced. We have 46 full-time ministers in the field in the United States, including the most recent hires. Of those 46, seven of them are products or graduates, I guess we'd say, of the Focused Mentoring Program, all within Church of God, a worldwide association. That's not even counting men like Larry Lambert or Paul Carter, who were trained in the training programs in the United Church of God. Mr. Richard Pennelly is manager of the ministerial services. Fine, train, ordain, he called it. That doesn't even count those men. So 17 out of 46, so basically 3 out of every 8 ministers we have already are products of CAGWA training. 3 out of every 8. So it's already happening, and it has to happen in an accelerated manner. But that's in this country. In international areas where we have half of our people and one quarter of our ministry, the average age is even older in the ministry. And then we had 2 unexpected deaths 4 years ago, Norman Hulagay in the Philippines and Manuel Quijano in Latin America. We had spent some time, my wife had a chance to spend some time with his widow who was there at the conference. Delightful lady. So we have to go forward. And that was the tone 2 years ago. Everything was looking great. This year, different tone. The theme, and I'll leave one brochure down here, the theme was spiritual leadership in perilous times. Learning from the past, preparing for the future. That certainly fit in with the whole class thing we've just been doing. But let me read you the theme verse. It's in 2 Timothy chapter 3. I'm sure you're familiar with 2 Timothy, this verse. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 1, but know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. That was the theme. It says, since our last conference in 2019, multiple troubles have flared up around the world. While some were surprising, such troubles are not unexpected because we know Paul's prophetic warning that in the last days perilous times will come. For the word perilous, the margin of the New King James Version offers this alternative translation, times of stress. All of the perils Paul listed had to do with worsening conditions related to human attitudes and behavior. But many other prophecies warn of troubling events that will also come upon the world. In the last 2 years, we have seen stresses of both kinds. The COVID-19 outbreak was a devastating event. And as we all know, it's not harnessed yet. We're obviously experiencing it in what is now your sister congregation in Cleveland. And we have more that we'll come back to learn more about today later. The COVID-19 outbreak was a devastating event, harming and killing millions worldwide. Simultaneously, we saw rapidly intensifying conditions of strife and animosity over political and social issues. I think all of us are probably asking ourselves, why is everybody so mad about everything these days? It just seems like people just get angry at the drop of a hat. While it is God who sees us through, he often uses his ministry to help his people navigate through trials and troubles. Therefore, this year's conference theme is Spiritual Leadership in Perilous Times. What have we learned? What does God want us to learn from these recent experiences? And how can we be better prepared to lead in the future? That was a welcoming message on the flyer in the back here by Mr. Franks. I will mention to you all the titles we covered, and then I want to take time with three of them because I think that they are the most telling of the presentations. Monday, the first day, Mr. Franks spoke on things that never change. That was the introductory address, keynote. Mr. Kylo followed up with preaching the gospel in a world on fire. Mr. Doug Horchak presented one on So Great a Cloud of Witnesses. That was basically recognizing all the new elders that have been ordained in the last 2 years. And there were several, but then sadly, those that have died in the last 2 years. And there were 16 elders and wives who have died in the last 2 years. God Will Provide, Mr. Britton Taylor, on looking forward in faith and the financial aspects of the church. Mr. Joel Meeker spoke on preparing for crisis leadership. He's been actually looking into and studying that very topic himself lately, crisis leadership. Then there were the 50th anniversary presentations, that is 50 anniversary years, 50 years since being ordained. Mr. Andre von Belkum, New Zealand, he was not able to be there. We had no one from Asia, no one from Europe. Two from Africa. Harris Lazo was able to come. We had some delightful conversations with him, and Kambani Banda was able to come. And we had 14, though, of our 17 Latin American elders were able to be present. So that was the only real area of the country, of the world presented. One elder from Canada, that's Mr. Harper, who's the pastor in Montreal. The other two elders there were not able to be there. So it was mostly U.S., but with a handful from the Latin American areas for the internationals. Mr. Bill Johns was given recognition for 50 years in the ordained ministry, and Mr. David Johnson, the FI instructor, 50 years as an ordained minister of Jesus Christ. Tuesday, second day, Mr. Walker talked about the international work, Leon Walker, international reports from three men, Dave Baker for Asia, Arnold Hampton for the Caribbean, and Joel Meeker for French-speaking areas. We had a presentation by Foundation Outreach International, some of the efforts that are being made to a world of good, is doing a world of good is the theme. Mr. David Register and Rhonda Waddell, who is the new executive director of FOI. It's not a church organization. It is a separate 501c3, and it's dedicated to kind of outreach. And for instance, we are actually able to be given some funding from corporations that they would never be able to give a church. But for a charitable organization dedicated to good works, they can support. So there's some corporate gift matching that goes on in different areas where companies will donate. And many of the projects are in Africa. Some of the camps in Africa are staffed by our young people in the church from here, and the various things that are going on. The Jordan Project is part of it, a big part of it, and various things that they talked about. Mr. David Johnson gave an update on Foundation Institute itself. we had a couple of presentations by some of the international areas. Saul Langarica spoke, and we had Mr. Von Belkum had taped a message to be recorded from New Zealand. Then we had the new minister's perspective. That was so popular last time. Some of our new hires spoke. We had three last time, and so this time there were two more. Caleb Froge. I told Caleb, I said, you know, if you want to stress how old some of the people around you are, just tell them that, you know, your mom used to work in the kitchen at Ambassador College with this guy. So, and that goes back many, many years, more than 50 exactly, 52, when I started working in the kitchen at Ambassador College. And Mr. David Jackson, who's our pastor in South Florida. He's not exactly a spring chicken by comparison. He said it's kind of odd when you're one of the new hires and you're on the cusp of 60, but that's just the way things have been. Both of them gave excellent presentations. I had a short presentation, which essentially you've heard today, on Foundation Institute class on modern church history, and then Mr. Franks wrapped up. There were international meetings on Wednesday, as well as the Doctrine Committee meeting, but that's the gist of the conference itself. Let me go into a little more detail on three of the presentations by two presenters, two by Mr. Franks, one by Mr. Kylo. Mr. Frank spoke the first day on things that never change. If you turn to Daniel chapter 7, he mentions this verse, and we're probably all of us familiar even more with the old King James translation of it than we are with the new. But in speaking of the things that never change, he rehearsed how we thought we had such forward momentum. And even in the early days of 2020, it wasn't obvious yet. Mr. Korchak was on a trip in Asia with Mr. Baker in January. And then he came home, but Mr. Baker continued. But then, as David Baker was telling us, he kept watching the news as he was traveling through parts of Asia and all the reports of this virus coming out of Wuhan, China. And by March 1st, he was scrambling, thinking, will I be able to get home? Or will all the international borders close while I'm over here? And he did make it back, but that's how fast it came up. How fast it came up. And so in Daniel 7, we read these words about speaking of the fourth beast in verse 23. The fourth beast shall be different from all other kingdoms. It talks about, as we get further forward in time and in prophecy, what the ten horns represent. And then in verse 25, it says, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. The New King James says, shall persecute the saints of the Most High and shall intend to change times and law. And then, at that future time, yet future, then the saints will be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time, the 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation. There will be some of God's people who will go into the Great Tribulation. But backing up that phrase, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, my margin has literally, from Hebrew, it means wear out. And that's the way it was translated in the Authorized Version or the King James Version. He shall persecute, or he shall wear out the saints of the Most High. And Mr. Frank says, to ask us, he said, do you sometimes feel like you're just worn out with the things that have been happening? And I think we all probably would say, yes, there are times when we do. We certainly do. And so he says, we need to assess where we are and focus on where we need to be. When we get into times like this and challenging times, we need to focus on what we can do, not what we have been denied access to or what we can't do anymore. He listed 8 ways that COVID-19 has changed the world. And I'll just read them reasonably slowly, so if you wanted to jot them down. He said, first of all, we have a new vocabulary. Social distancing. You know. In-person meetings. Meetings were always in person. That way you define in-person church services. That's new vocabulary. Wardrobe addition. And he said, I always have to carry a little mask with me these days, just about wherever I go, just in case I need it. A wardrobe addition. In fact, they've become items of wardrobe. You see some really fancy designed ones sometimes. Me, I'm just boring, you know. Historians are boring. They wear the prepared kind. Anxiety, depression, and suicide, a third way. The statistics are not encouraging. What's called a fourth way that things have changed, some researchers point out what they call pandemic drinking. No public rites like church services, weddings, and funerals. Those were suspended for a time. That was number 5. 6, worldwide poverty because of the effects economically. How many businesses have closed and will never reopen? Our world has changed. Number 7, school closings. Our granddaughter's school has gone to virtual again this week down in South Carolina. But her mom, our daughter, of the school she works at and teaches at, hasn't. So that can be challenging. And, of course, the new vaccines that changed the world, too. He says those are all ways that the world has changed, and almost every one of them has caused division. Almost every one of them has caused division. And then he asks, what does all of this do to the church of God? That's the key question for all of us. He pointed out that The strongest of relationships will grow weak without contact. The strongest of relationships will grow weak without contact. And then he asks us, what part has Satan played in all this? Now, we're not going to just look for him, the devil behind every rock and tree, and we don't want to get kind of weird about it, but to assume that he had no part in it would be a mistake. What part has he played? Mr. Frank said, one thing for sure we can say that he has contributed to are lies and confusion. Lies and confusion. That's a description of our world today. You read verses like 1 Corinthians 14, for example. 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 33, another verse familiar to us, I'm sure, where it says, 1 Corinthians 14, 33, God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all churches of the saints. And then John 8, 44, where Jesus told the Pharisees, he said, you are of your father the devil. John 8 and verse 44, he said, you are of your father the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He, the devil, was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. So obviously, when God is not the author of confusion and when he does not ever lie, Satan is just the opposite. And that's where he has come in. And we must assume, as Mr. Frank said, that he is pleased. Satan is pleased with what's gone on in the world. He talks about people being angry and upset. And then he said, what should we focus on? Specifically, he was speaking to the ministry, but to everybody in God's church. And his answer, on the things that never change. The things that never change. And he talked about John 6:44, you know, how God, no man can come to me except the Father draws him, and I will raise him up again at the last day. That has not changed. That is God's purpose. He quoted and gave a very interesting graphic description with his PowerPoint backup about an old high school coach, baseball coach from years ago. He amused all of us by saying, I love baseball. And a few minutes later, he would say, did I tell you I love baseball? And he put up a picture of his 1968 district championship team from his school. And he said he wasn't going to leave it up too long because he didn't want people trying to figure out which one he was in that picture. And everybody was, I think he's there. I think you know. Yeah, of course, he looks a little different now than he did in 1968, as you might well imagine. But at any rate, then he quoted a high school baseball coach in the Baseball Hall of Fame, the National High School Baseball Hall of Fame. His name was Morgan Gilbert. The things that never change. And he gave an address at some conference, and he asked, he said, you know, in different levels of the sport, there are different stats, there are different measurements. In professional baseball, it's 90 feet between bases. And home, the pitcher's mound and home plate are 60 feet 6 inches apart. But the walls, you know, down the left field line, it may be 302 feet one place or 340 feet someplace else. Or center field may be 400 feet away here and 415 feet away here. And the wall can be different shapes and sizes and different amounts of foul territory. But so he asked the question, he says, how wide is home plate? And Mr. Franks had a diagram up there. 17 inches. It's shaped as a five-sided figure, 17 inches wide. It comes down 8 inches from that, and then it tapers in 12 inches down to a point. 17 inches. So this coach would ask now, he said, oh, I've got all you wise people out there. How wide is the home plate in the Pony League or American Legion Leagues? And finally, somebody would say, 17 inches? That's right, 17 inches. How wide is home plate with, you know, T-ball? 17 inches? That's right, 17 inches. And his whole presentation was, in baseball at least, that is one figure that never changes. Home plate is 17 inches wide. Mr. Frank said, you know, if there's a pitcher who just can't seem to pitch over home plate, you don't go and say, well, you know what, we'll make home plate 18 inches wide for you so you have a better chance of throwing a strike. Doesn't work that way. And that was his point. There are things that never change. And that's the point for us. Our focus, he said, as ministers, must be on those things that never change. And that's what we are endeavoring to preach about and teach about in God's way. You know, who called us? Well, we know that. God the Father opened our minds and drew us to Him, drew us to His Son. That never changes. It says in Hebrews 2, verse 1, therefore we must give the more earnest heed to the things we have heard, lest we drift away. As he said, God and His calling, that is central to everything we do. And then he kept repeating, home plate is 17 inches wide. You know, he would make a statement and they would say, home plate is 17 inches wide. Just come back to it all the time. The gospel hasn't changed. The truth has not changed, although sometimes our understanding and grasp of it has been. And I can echo that from church history. There are things we have come to understand in the last 100 years or so of the church, 95 or so, that were not clearly understood before. Sometimes even including something as important as the annual holy days. There were some elements of God's church that we know didn't have a very full understanding of it. They had the Sabbath, virtually, and all of them had the Passover concept. Although, if you go back far enough and early enough and independent enough, some of them didn't have that right either in terms of the timing. We don't know all the details. As we stress in the class, we look in history for Sabbath keepers just because that's the easiest place to begin. There are no Christians who don't keep the Sabbath. I'll just make a blunt statement, because that's God's commandment, you know. 1 John 2, he who says, I know him and keeps not his commandments is a liar and the truth is not in him. That's a core. You must begin with that. But from there, Waldo. Where's Waldo? God knows where Waldo is. God knows. Home plate is still 17 inches wide. He talked about the importance of shepherds in Hebrews chapter 10, verses 24 and 25. He says, the job of the shepherds, let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another so much the more as you see the day approaching. That's important. Home plate is still 17 inches wide. That's basically the way he ended his presentation. The things that never change. Mr. Kyle then spoke on preaching the gospel in a world on fire. He talked about some of his personal recollections of coming into the church as a boy in the early 1960s. And as he said, we don't often think about it maybe as much as we ought to, but he says the world of that time was a world on fire. He talked about, you know, the early presidency of John F. Kennedy. Before the Cuban Missile Crisis, you had the Bay of Pigs attempted invasion to overthrow the communist regime. And then you had the Cuban Missile Crisis when there were nuclear warheads parked just 90 miles away from the U.S. shores, targeting the major cities of the East Coast. And for about 2 weeks, the world trembled on the brink as Kennedy went toe-to-toe with Khrushchev in Moscow. And he said it was a world on fire. It was a world of the Cold War. It was a world that then began to have social upheavals. The civil rights movement, in so many cases and places, turned violent. There were difficulties. There were challenges. Then there was Vietnam. And those of us who were alive at that time, you know, I can still, if you press me for it, I can still tell you my selective service draft number. That's part of the weirdness of knowing numbers, but I had to register for the draft when I turned 18 and was deferred because I was first a student at Ambassador College and then because I was an ordained minister. But I had to carry my draft card till I was 35 by law, U.S. law, and at least have it available. So that was a world on fire. And as he said, that's when he came into the church, my wife and I, both similar time period. And it was a world on fire. And in a way, he says, you know what happens when there are challenges and stresses and people are afraid of something happening? They listen. They listen to the message. And those were the years in which the church grew the fastest, from the late 50s through the 60s into the early 70s and a little bit beyond. That's when we went from 12 or 15,000 keeping the feast in the late 1950s to 60 or 70,000 keeping the feast in just 10 years, or 50-some thousand. If we had had the same increase in growth in festival observance in the Church of God, a worldwide association, in these last 10 years, we had roughly 10,000 keeping the feast with us the very first year. We would have 54,000 keeping the feast with us now, 50 to 55,000. What would we do with them all? That's how fast it grew. It was a world on fire. So he says, you have to understand, response to the message is often linked to world conditions. And then he talked about the story, and that's just the story of human nature. When things are easy and soft, people don't get serious about things. When it's troubled times, then they sometimes listen more. But, as he said, those times also prove challenging for us. They are challenging for us as we strive to do God's work. He talked about the events of the last 17 months have made us wonder what lies ahead. We are the ones who are, well, we are spiritually focused on what we should be doing. We are, I guess you'd say that there will always be fires that will break out. We are, I guess you'd say, we're spiritual firefighters in some ways. There are external threats that are difficult to predict. There are internal threats that actually are some more predictable from a biblical history, what happens in time. External perils always present the same internal challenge. The biggest one we have is to prepare for the internal opportunities and strategies that the next external perilous times will present us. How can we get ready knowing what we know lies ahead in prophecy? And talks about the trend. People tend to resist the truth despite that because we live in a world of moral decay. You know, you think back, again, history, the Great Depression, late 1929 into the 30s. How did people respond? Well, for the most part, they just tightened their belts and they somehow tried to make do and get by. If we were to have times like that set in now, what would be the response of the population at large? I think we've had a little bit of a tutorial for the last year and a half, don't you? And it's not a pretty picture. So you can tell the tone of the conference was very different this time. It was very focused on, these are challenging times we live in, and it's probably just a shot across the bow for what lies ahead. We're not there yet. And a lot of us were saying, Dr. Levy one time, were saying we really believe God has given us these tools as a part of a preparation for what yet lies ahead. You know, even the Olivet Prophecy, Jesus cites certain conditions, and then he says, these are just the beginning of sorrows. The end is not yet. And that's something we need to keep in mind. The prophet was told, you know, if you can't contend with the foot soldiers, how will you run with the horses? So we do have some challenges. Mr. Kylo asked this. He said, we can pretty much predict what human nature in general terms will do and how it will react, and in our society the moral decay makes it worse. He says, how will this affect the preaching of the gospel? He said, well, first of all, there will be two types of challenge and trouble. Events, like outlined in the Olivet Prophecy, perilous times, troubles, Jacob's trouble prophesied, and then conditions. He said that's another factor in preaching the gospel in difficult times. A deteriorating condition of human character and mindset, and confusion about who and what we are, even as human beings. You know, and going through some of this COVID testing, we are getting tested Monday. It'll be the fifth time we've been tested since March. And one of the panels for detailing information, it says it's optional, but you can fill in, what was your gender assigned at birth? Who would have thought such a thing just a few years ago? Gender assigned at birth? Yeah, or what is your gender? Well, I always thought there were only two. But our world is confused and challenged. And so these are some of the things we face with a deteriorating condition of human mindset and character, a deteriorating social order, an atmosphere that could you can see tend toward persecuting those who stand up for standards. Those are the things. Restraints are removed. When you think about the verse, because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Matthew 24. A widespread hardening of hearts may lie ahead. Then he says, when these things begin to happen, look at the book of Revelation. All the plagues that are poured out toward the end. This is my insert here. Mr. Kylo, you know, sort of hinted at it. What is the reaction from people? And it says, but they did not repent. They hardened their hearts. It's just incredible what it will take. So he said, okay, what don't we know? Well, we don't know the specifics of the events that lie ahead. We don't know the challenges. How long will things take? I remember a minister years ago saying the prophesied events are taking longer to actually unfold and develop than we ever thought would happen. But he says, I have a feeling that when they do begin to happen, it will all cascade more quickly than we ever thought possible. And that may be true. What don't we know about preaching the gospel? Well, we do know about Matthew 24. It's to be preached in all the world as a witness. We do know that there will come a time, according to Amos, when there will be a famine of the hearing of the word. God will send it, it says. Then, why will that happen? How will it happen? Why does he do it? And he explains in Amos chapter 8. I'll let you look that up yourself. John 9 and verse 4, Jesus said, the night is coming when no man can work. Those are things to think about. He says, an environment will exist, Mr. Kylo said, in which people will reject the gospel. And in time, they will act against it. That's what prophecy seems to indicate. He says, there will come a time when God's work will be carried out, as we know from Revelation, by two individuals, the two witnesses. And I'm sure all of us would say, I'm not volunteering for that one. Miracles will be provided, but what a time it will be. But God says, he promises in Isaiah 55 that his word will not return to him void. When it's about prophecy, it will accomplish what he sent it. He will accomplish what he sent it. So these are some of the challenges that we face looking ahead and preaching the gospel. As we go on fighting fires in one sense from without, will we also be fighting fires from within because of the challenges of the world in which we live? Our primary focus, he says, should it be on specific crises to arise or on the commonality of it all, on core spiritual issues, on character, on our relationship with God? It kind of harkens back to Mr. Frank's message on the things that don't change. Then he talked about six issues of spiritual leadership. And he says, and all of us should be preaching on it. So the challenge of faith, he cited Stephen, the first martyr. We know about that in the book of Acts. They're all starting with the challenge. So challenge of faith is number one. Challenge of wisdom and discernment. There's a passage in 1 Chronicles 12 about one family of priests that understood, had an understanding of the times. That would be critical. The challenge of keeping our focus. We don't want to get off message. What did Jesus preach? We want to preach the same message, the gospel of the kingdom of God. We have to be centered on his thinking. The challenge of courage. The challenge of courage. The challenge of unity. And the final challenge of keeping our focus and our hearts on God, one another, and the truth. Because as he said, the truth steps on toes. He says our website, Life, Hope, and Truth. He said, who wouldn't want to hear more about life? Who wouldn't want to hear more about truth? About hope? Who wouldn't want to hear more about hope? Yeah, we like that. What about truth? Careful, you know, don't contradict what I've always thought. So we always have our challenges. We see it starting to happen. He says, we know that in a world like this, Satan will make it rain lies all around us. I thought that was an interesting way of putting it. Satan will make it rain lies. And then he says, can we still preach the truth? So that was his presentation on preaching the gospel in a world on fire. And then I want to take just a few minutes to summarize Mr. Frank's final address on Tuesday as he finished the conference. He said the title in the brochure, and I've got it right here. You'll see it there if you look at it. Just says concluding remarks, Jim Franks. He said he deliberately withheld the title, and then he gave it to us when he spoke. His title is, he said, "Everything I Needed to Know I Learned from My Grandkids." And he says, are their grandchildren, they have five from the ages of 5 to 22. And he talked about some of the things, some of the touching stories from grandkids. And I'm sure those of us who have grandchildren all have a bunch of those stories. They do. We just do. They're delightful, and as you see, they're growing awareness of things. They're growing understanding of things. And you see some of these things come out in their humor that just catch you by surprise sometimes. And sometimes their assessment of things can be disarmingly straightforward. But as he pointed out, the last 17 months have in some ways tended to throw the human race off track. And he says, if we're not careful, it can throw us off track. But you know, as he said, children sometimes have a way of just bringing you right back to the basics. And they ask a question that you say, well, yeah, you know, that hasn't changed. And they ask something really obvious. The trivial sometimes has become substantial in the last year and a half. The substantial has become trivial. And he says, where's the balance? Where's the balance? He talked about the famous photograph taken on Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima in World War II. Most of us have probably seen that photograph of the six Marines raising the flag on Iwo Jima. And two of the six Marines were misidentified. One of them was misidentified, and one individual who was a Native American from Arizona was aware that his buddy that was the one planting the flag, who was killed later in the fighting, was misidentified. And he wanted the parents to know, and Mr. Franks related the story of how he walked 1,300 miles from his home to the home of this young man's parents in Texas just to tell them that it was their son, because he wanted it to be known. Well, that did get corrected back in 1946, a year later. But the last one was just identified in 2016. There were six Marines on that hill, and the last one was finally identified by DNA and connections with living relatives in 2016. But he talked about the phrase in war, how that was on a hill, that was on a mountain in Iwo Jima, in one of the last battles of World War II in the Pacific. And the phrase is coined, the hill you want to die on. So he talked about that in terms of God's truth. He talked about the fact, you know, is the hill you want to die on this trivial thing? Is the hill you want to die on, you know, face coverings? Is the hill you want to die on this or that issue? And he threw out a whole bunch of them. Is the hill you want to die on how the pandemic started? Is the hill you want to die on? And he said, you know, none of those make any sense. If we think about what is it that is most important, he says, no issue of this world is that hill. No issue of this world is that hill. The only issue is God's truth. That's the hill. And he says, for us as ministers, the care for the brethren and a care for our families, preaching the gospel, those are hills to die on. Do we all, he said, work for God? He said that was one of the funny stories that came up, that one of his little grandchildren, their daughter, I think, was trying to explain. Well, Papa said this. Well, who does Papa work for? Well, Papa works for God. And you know, the eyes get really big. You know, Papa works for God? Well, in that sense, yeah, that's true. But a child's perspective, a young child, is very different. And as he said, that hasn't changed in the last 17 months. We all work for God. He said, Satan seeks to destroy through lies, through half-truths, through distorted facts. And then he said, you know, it's interesting to go to Matthew 9, and this is the one I'll finish with. Matthew 9, it's interesting to see what it was that grieved Jesus Christ. And of course, he was speaking to us as the ministry. In Matthew chapter 9, it says in verse 35, then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. But when he saw the multitudes, verse 36, what was it that so moved him? He was moved with compassion for them, because they were weary. One translation says they were harassed. They were harassed and scattered like sheep having no shepherd. Interesting. And then he said, the harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. And that pretty much concluded a very sobering, but also deeply meaningful conference. I'm sure we all came away from it with those thoughts. We have had a handful of reports of ministers or wives who have begun to have symptoms of sickness following. Not a great deal, but a handful. And so we're still waiting on confirmations and reports. That's why my wife and I are wearing our masks today, because we know we're exposed to someone who almost certainly, and when he gets his results back, will be positive. We've had the antibodies from having recovered, so hopefully we'll have good news for you Monday. We certainly fully expect that, but as for now, you won't be able to see quite all of our charming faces for the rest of the day. Well, one face is charming anyway. We will not see you next week. Next week will be a Meadville and Cleveland Sabbath, but we'll be back again on the following Sabbath, the 11th. And, of course, trumpets in between there. Do you realize 1 month from today is the last great day? Oh, shocking. Well, with that, on that cheery note, I will end.